If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Healthcare for Humans, hosted by Dr. Sundar, expands our understanding of the history and culture of different communities and how to provide culturally responsive care. There's an episode you should check out where guest Dr. Duran details the systemic barriers faced by individuals with DACA status and highlights the importance of addressing these barriers. Check out Healthcare for Humans on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the On the Road to the Gambia podcast, where we are bridging boundaries for global health equity. I am Dr. Carol Penn, doubly board certified in family medicine and obesity medicine. I am a best-selling author and a master meditation, movement, and mindset coach, serving as the director of Tracks and Electives, assistant professor of family medicine at our nation's newest medical school, Rocky Vista University, Montana College of Osteopathic Medicine. I am the proud co-founder of the Institute for Community Evolution. Together with Sunuryu, the University of the Gambia, Penn Global Visions, and the Edward Francis Smalls Teaching Hospital, we are fostering a new era of global healthcare collaboration. I'm excited to bring you the amazing stories of 15 clinicians from the U.S. who will travel to the Gambia and exchange cutting-edge knowledge with Gambian medical professionals to uplift communities and empower each other to become compassionate and culturally sensitive healthcare leaders on both sides of the Atlantic. So put on your headphones and listen as we explore this transformative journey to the Gambia.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the On the Road to Gambia podcast. I am your host, Dr. Lisa Herbert, a board-certified family physician, best-selling author, speaker, and executive leadership coach. And I help physicians transition into leadership roles so that they can become the respective voices in healthcare. So I'm excited to bring another guest to you today. And we're going to be speaking with Dr. Sarah Irene Washington. So I'm going to just read her bio and then we'll get into the discussion. But first, as you know, this podcast is highlighting the steps of 15 clinicians from the United States embarking on a transformative journey with the Institute of Community Evolution, Sunuryu, University of Gambia, Penn Global Visions, and the Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital to foster a new era of global healthcare collaboration. So today, again, we're talking with Dr. Sarah Irene Washington, and Dr. Washington is a board-certified pediatrician and a pediatric urgent care physician with more than 10 years of experience having treated over 40,000 patients. She is currently a school-based pediatrician for Morris Heights Health Center. Dr. Washington is a native Brooklynite, Brooklyn, and a product of New York City public schools. She graduated from Midwood High School in the medical science program. Dr. Washington earned a Bachelor of Science in Biology with a concentration in molecular biology from Hampton University and obtained her Doctorate of Medicine from SUNY Downstate Medical Center. She completed her pediatrics residency at Maria Ferreira Children's Hospital at Westchester Medical Center. Dr. Washington is the best-selling author of her book, Should We Go to Urgent Care? She was a 2020 inductee into the Hampton University 40 Under 40 Alumni Recognition Society. Dr. Washington serves on the Board of Managers in a Diversity of Committee Membership Program in the SUNY Downstate Alumni Association College of Medicine. She also serves as the Media and Marketing Secretary of the Susan Smith McKinney Stewart Medical Society. Dr. Washington has been featured in interviews on ABC, Eyewitness News, and News 12 Westchester. She's also a blog contributor for Forbes.com and a dynamic speaker serving as a keynote or a panelist. She is the primary caregiver for her mother. She's a sister and an aunt of two nieces. She's a classically trained pianist, world traveler, humanitarian, and philanthropist who supports multiple organizations that sponsor and enrich children, as well as the underserved. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we have so much in common. I mean, being from Brooklyn.
Let's start there.
Unless, yeah, please.
Round of applause always for Brooklyn.
entire Brooklyn connection. I mean, you just kind of feel the energy. Mm-hmm. And then you went to Midwood High School. I went to James Madison High School.
Oh, so they may not know that we are rivals. It's a friendly banter, though. But yes, we are rivals to those out there.
And then you attended SUNY for medical school. Now, I went to SUNY Upstate, but still, you know, the SUNY
system. Oh, more connections. I did not realize SUNY is an excellent state program. I'm so happy that we are New Yorkers where we could go to a state school, because Hampton and other private institutions are expensive. So to get an excellent education from a state school, so priceless, and blessed to be able to be a recipient of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't realize how blessed and fortunate we were after graduating, and then talking with a lot of my other colleagues and realizing you spent how much?
Exactly.
Right.
Because my loans, I stopped counting after a while. And your loan, I was like, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, yes. So, you know, being from Brooklyn and having, you know, obviously that sense of community, I just love Brooklyn because of its diversity and how people just kind of gravitate towards each other, stick together. So who or what inspired you, you know, along this journey of becoming a pediatrician and then some of the other, you know, community involvement and things that you're involved with?
I love this question. So first, I will admit that I always wanted to be a doctor growing up. And it started as thinking that you could do everything. So it was started as I want to be a doctor and a lawyer and a teacher and president and a singer. You know, you think you can do everything, right? And then as you get older and then you start taking things off of the list, then doctor was still on the list. So it was also something that I knew that it was that not, I still loved it, and there were other things that I was like, I do not like that anymore. You know, and starting with that. And yes, I did still love playing the piano, but I did not think of doing that professionally. I did love to do it as a hobby. And yes, I was a pianist for my high school's mixed chorus, so that I did do it up until that point in my formative training. But then once I got to Hampton, I decided to just be singing in the choir. I decided to shift from, okay, playing, because that is also a lot of time. And I still wanted to be a doctor, knew that would take a lot of time. So It was just more so figuring out which area I wanted to go into. So initially I thought that I was going to be an OBGYN. I thought I was going to be delivering babies. And then as time went on, when I was in medical school, so up until my fourth year of med school, I had done some research programs in OBGYN. I had done all of these things thinking that was the route I was going to go. And this is why they say do not wear blinders in med school and keep your options open, because then pediatrics came and surprised me. At first, I was like, I don't want to take care of sick children, but I grew to like it. And now here I am. And even more so, I'm in a school-based clinic. I'm still at school, still at work now. So look where life takes you. So it's a testament of showing that even when you think you may have an idea of what you want to do, it is okay to change your mind. So here I am.
Absolutely. So the more you tell your story, the more things I'm finding, of course, that we have in common again. So I went through that same transition in high school. I went from being a computer technologist to an engineer to a mathematician, to you name it, right? I was going to do it. Lawyer was in there too.
Right.
And then just like you, like everything else started to kind of just fall off. I took a computer class, hated it. Math really wasn't my thing. Lawyer, I was like, oh, that's boring. And everything else fell off. And then, like you said, you know, medicine was still there at the end of the day. Yeah. And same thing with medical school, OBGYN, I just knew. I actually have a whole letter written up. You know how we had to write those letters about being an OBGYN. It was about being an OBGYN.
My personal statement was on personal that statement. As well. So was mine. Yes. We can compare that as well.
Yes. And then I did that one night of call. That did it for me.
Interestingly, I still loved my OBGYN courtship. I really still thought I was going to do it. And it was like also the time of what's going on in the world. And there were some interesting changes going on in healthcare during the time of my transition from my third year into my fourth year in medical school. And there were a lot of things going on where we didn't know if it was just going to be that 1 year as far as the pendulum swing, would it swing right back or would it take longer? And so then I had been meeting with people, including like the associate director of the OBGYN department at Downstate, my own gynecologist, everyone that I talked to, and they were all like saying, we don't know what's going on here. And yes, we love it. But for someone coming in, if there's anything else you like, you should think about it. And I thought, what else do I like? And it was like, okay, I do not like sick adults if it's not a women's issue. So there's that.
Yeah. Right, right.
High blood pressure in adults, I really know.
Right.
So then it was like, okay, I could kind of think about pediatrics. And then I thought about doing pediatric emergency medicine because I still wanted to be able to do procedures. And then that did not end up going in the path that I thought it would. But then I ended up doing urgent care for 9.5 years. So that... So yeah, so I did still get a taste of things like where I still got to do a lot of laceration repair. So I did a lot of stitching like several times a week, foreign body removals. Mm-hmm. I would drain abscesses. So I still got the taste of doing procedures without, and then I would still get the kids who came in with anaphylaxis, so severe allergic reactions. So I would still manage them. If they had some like vomiting, I can manage that as well. Croup, like the barky cough, we can manage because we would be open until midnight. So I did still get a taste of like the lower acuity things that would be seen in an emergency room. And then those that actually did require more care, also injuries, we had x-ray machines there. But if they needed more, then we would transfer them to the emergency room. Like, okay, we have gone as far as we can go. And now go forth, God bless. And we'll call tomorrow to see how you're doing.
Right, right.
So I did still get to do procedures, which was great for me because I did not want to do the same thing all the time where, you know, I do get bored. And so the thing I do like here in the school-based clinic is even though I don't do nearly as many procedures, it is still kind of like an urgent care because of all the kids who come in who are sick for the day. They're not feeling well, so you still have to take care of them then. But this, the good thing for those that do not know about school-based clinics is that it functions as a full clinic. So it's not like when we think of the days when they say, oh, go to the nurse's office if your school has a nurse, because I remember my school did not. Right, there was an office, but it was empty, right? But, you know, it's not just going to see a nurse because I don't even have a nurse on staff here, which we can talk about later as far as staffing. So I do full physicals here. I give immunizations. So a lot of children who need to get caught up on their vaccines, we do that. And this school is 3 schools in one. So one is a charter school, ages grades 5 through 8, then there's a high school, and then there's also a technical school for those who just graduated high school, want to get some technical training as far as becoming an electrician or a hairdresser or things like that. So it's a wide range of children. So for the older, like the teens and young adults, we do a lot of reproductive care. So I did get training in how to place Nexplanons, which are the implants, and the arm, and then IUDs, intrauterine devices for birth control. I also give other forms of birth control as well. I do STD testing and treatment. So it's a lot of things that still happen in the clinic. So it does, it does lead to very busy days.
Wow. I didn't realize that you did all of that. So if I am part of the school system, like do I make an appointment? Like, how do they sort of get to see you?
Yeah. So great question. So a day in the life of a school-based physician, right? So you can do both. You can schedule appointments. So physicals, right? And then also sports physicals for those who need to be play on teams. That is separate than a regular well child visit because there are certain questions and that we have to ask based on the child's medical history. Also the family history, right? Is there anything that is in the family that would make us a little more cautious as to whether or not they can be cleared to play sports? And we're seeing in the news now, there are a lot of athletes that we see that they just fall out. And we're trying to figure out, is there a genetic cause to that? Because if we did know that, then we might have them see some specialists before that to either say, no, you cannot play, or you can play with certain restrictions. So we're very strict about that. So we do sports physicals as well. So we make appointments for physicals and for reproductive care. We make appointments for those as well, right? Because those are technically not emergencies. Granted, we do also do emergency contraception, and that is on the time frame, right? So then those kids are more so walk-ins. A pregnancy test is also a walk-in that we will do. But we do try to make appointments and then leave the rest of the, so that there are a few on the schedule per day, but then the rest gets filled in by walk-ins. So then walk-ins would walk in and state what their issue is. And then we, if we have room, we put them on the schedule right then. And then there also, we do have a couple of daily medications. So for children who have chronic illnesses where they have to take a medication every day, for example, some with ADHD, or if they have type 1 diabetes where they have to get their insulin levels checked to see how much to give, especially for the younger ones who need help calculating that number, then they would come in every single day. Or an asthma kid. So say for someone who you know that before they exercise, well, when they exercise, they will start having symptoms. So if you know that's a thing and they have gym every day, then before gym, they would come in and then just take their puffs of their inhaler and then go to gym class, right? Versus trying to get them after the fact. And now they're wheezing and going through all the changes we try to prevent. So we do those daily medications. So those, for the daily meds, those students have to bring in a form from their primary. So that stating if X, then Y. So for this condition, they can have these things. So that even if I am not here for the day and there's someone else here, there is a doctor's order stating, yes, this patient comes in every day for this, you may give it. And then that is how we do that as well.
Yeah. You're busy.
Yes.
Because, you know, there are not many, at least from what I remember about pediatrics or know about pediatricians, not many of them are as involved in the reproductive care aspect, especially with the procedural, right, treatments or preventions rather, like the Nexplanon and IUDs and all of that stuff that you do.
This is new for me as well. I just started working in the school-based system with Morris Heights a little over a year ago. So this is also a new experience for me as well. So it's a learning experience for me. So that is one thing that I was happy to learn. You know, you glean the good, right? So I was like, oh, this is a little clinical pearl I can take with me, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Always, so, you know, always the learner, right? The doctor.
Absolutely.
So I was like, I'll add that to my repertoire.
Yes. It's always a good thing. It's always a good thing when you can add some new skills and some new knowledge. So let's switch now to this trip that's coming up, right? To the Gambia.
I'm so excited. I've been telling everybody. When they're like, so when's your next ship? Well, actually, I will be going to Gambia in January of 2024.
yes oh my gosh, it's such an exciting time. And you know, I think for each of us we have our own reasons for going. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to sort of volunteer your time and expertise to go on this trip.
I have always wanted to do a medical mission. So I did know some friends of mine who, after the fact, I learned they had done medical missions when we were in medical school. So they had done an elective. I was like, why didn't anyone tell me? Right? Then, you know, residency, where they might have done an away elective somewhere. And for some reason, I wasn't able to do it. So there was always something that happened where I was not able to go. There was one trip I was even planning to go to Cuba. And then we even started sending deposits and that got canceled. So there was always something that happened. And then finally, this presented itself. And Africa is by far my favorite continent. And I have yet to make it to the Gambia. But so far, I have been to... Let's count them. So I've been to Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and Seychelles. So it's seven. And so I'm ready to add number eight and do a medical mission as well. So it's a 2-for-1. So I'm so excited.
Wow. You've been to all those places.
Yes. Yeah, some of them were groups, right? The ones that were closest together were, you know, you did two, three, like, so South Africa, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, that was one trip.
One trip. Okay.
And then with Zambia and Zimbabwe, because we had gone to Victoria Falls. And so there is a bridge, the Zambezi Bridge, and where you're crossing the Zambezi River. So you can basically have one foot on Zambia's side, 1 foot on Zimbabwe's side. So you really can walk across. Right. And the waterfall spans across where you can actually walk through. So we didn't just do 1 foot kind of thing. We did actually go to the other side, see the views from over there. But that's what we really did there. And we did, some of us did bungee jumps. And I will say that it was my one and only time bungee jumping, because I figured if I was going to do it, why just go off a building or an amusement park? This is where you do it.
Do it, right.
I did jump off the Zambezi Bridge. So a little adventure too.
Very adventurous. I don't know that I would have done that, but.
Oh, when they people are like, will you do it again? Yes, yes. I was like, no.
No.
Because the headache that I got afterwards, the blood rushed right to my head. And I was like, okay, that was enough. I can say that I did it. And I got the footage to prove that I did it.
So, you know, you are, you know, obviously very well-versed in what you do. And like I said, you know, you have expanded your knowledge in the pediatric field and to include other areas. So what are you hoping to bring to the Gambia in terms of your expertise, your qualities, your knowledge? What do you think, what are you hoping to bring and what do you think will be brought forward during your time there?
So I have been thinking about this, like, what can I bring to the table, right? I think that I can bring first the knowledge of knowing about vaccination, specifically HPV vaccination, being that that is part of my wheelhouse. We do start vaccinating as young as the age of 9. Sometimes we wait until 11. But the point is that we try to vaccinate against HPV, which is human papillomavirus, before children get active, right? So lots of times parents are like, oh, their child isn't having sex. And we're like, exactly, because we want to get them before they're exposed to anything. Right. So then you get them beforehand, then that helps prevent different forms, you know, something that could lead to cervical cancer. HPV can also cause cancer of the throat, mouth, and anus. So for the boys too, the boys may think, oh, that doesn't affect them, but it does.
Hey, leading ladies, stay right there and we will be back with my amazing guests. This conversation is so good that you don't want to miss it. So stay tuned.
Right. So not only is it that you can unknowingly pass it on to a woman, you yourself can get cancer as a boy. So we want to try to get everyone vaccinated. And from what I was reading, sadly, cervical cancer is the number one leading cancer of women in the Gambia from ages 15 to 44, something around that, like that adult age range. They have a lot of, they do have a high number of cervical cancer. Yes, it's just something that I'm very interested in and very passionate about, of making and trying to promote vaccination, and to also press the points that it is not that we are stating that, oh, that's going to encourage them to do anything earlier. It is strictly to catch them before they're exposed to anything. Because I do know I had a college classmate who was diagnosed with cervical cancer. So I'm just now 42. She was diagnosed maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. So the fact that she got it at such a young age, also knowing that I looked for the vaccine myself, but it came out when I turned 26. And initially they said they recommended it from just 9 to 26. So then my gynecologist, when I asked for it, was like, well, you're already 26. And so they did not really offer it. And I was like, but I still want it. And he was like, well, you know, so the fact that, you know, for people who would have benefited, and they may not, now they've extended the ages, thankfully, but you know, it's always good to have preventative things. You want to prevent whichever way you can. So if there's a way to prevent cervical cancer, then I'm all for it, or any other form. If those other forms of cancer that are due to HPV, I'm for that. So that is number one. Number two, the knowledge that I have of pediatric urgent care, of how to do laceration repairs. So just simple things as far as stitching. I'm so sorry. This is what happens when you work and live in New York City. So I'm in the Bronx right now. So you're going to hear certain things. Now, you know, in real time, right? The custodian came, right. Ambulance is in the background. We are live in the city. Okay, better? Okay. So the knowledge of how to do suturing, where you don't, like when their plastic surgeon is not available, right? Mm, so yeah. when I was at when I did pediatric urgent care, for the things that were more complicated, we did have like a little list of plastic surgeons that were in the area that we would call them and then have the child meet them in the whichever emergency room they were taking call at in that night, or some, or maybe if they something to set up that they may see them the following day. Usually that night we would send them, right?
Yeah.
But one, as we know, plastic surgeons are way more expensive. And lots of times, even if you have insurance, it's not going to be completely covered. Mm-hmm. So then there might be a lot of people that, especially in this neighborhood, cannot even afford that, right? So then they would forego plastics, but then the child would still need to be treated. Mm-hmm. So then we would do the repairs. And I prided myself in my work, right? That I did get very proficient in doing suturing repairs. So then that is something that I can bring to the table. I can only do like two layers deep, right? I'm not going on past the muscle neck. I can skin. I can do like the fatty tissue. That's it. Anything beyond that, I tap out. But I can, if it's something that's just most cuts that you don't really need more than that, then I will have it looking pretty nice, if I do say so myself, so that I can bring just also the knowledge and the comfort of draining abscesses, because some people, if they're not used to doing procedures, they're scared of that. And I have had to help other physicians that may have done training in other areas where they were just doing straight clinic work, where they may not be comfortable with how to do that. So just even just because, you know, lots of times you get more comfortable just the more you do something. So I had to become more comfortable because I did it so often, right? Yeah. So just draining abscesses, foreign body removals. You know, now the thing of foreign body removals, if it comes to the ears and the nose, there are some instruments that we use. So I'm not sure if those are available in the Gambia. Because those are instruments that are specifically for the nose and the ears. So they're safe so that they do not injure the body, right? They may not be comfortable going in, because I've had children, you know, like, you hurt me. And I was like, I'm sorry, but I didn't put it in there. So who did that?
Right.
I didn't put that popcorn in your ear, right? You know, that kernel. I didn't stick that bean up in your nose, you know, so. And we had to get it out. It couldn't stay in there, you know?
Right.
Just becoming more comfortable with those things. So just those sort of procedures, I can also help contribute to that. And even just the knowledge of urgent care, things that you don't necessarily need a critical care person for, but how to manage allergic reactions and like how long to manage them for. Like, you know, there has to be an observation period thereafter, because sometimes even if after you give medication, the symptoms can come back. How do you handle that when that occurs? How to treat other things. Like, once again, I gave an example of croup or asthma exacerbations. We do that as well. So we have nebulizer machines here. So just quick reviews of certain things that they will probably already be aware of. But then it's always good to just try to enhance the curriculum, right, if we may. So just trying to bring like maybe the urgent care aspects of things that I've learned and some of the adolescent medicine knowledge that I've come across. And of course, just always pushing for immunization, because that in itself is one of the main tools that we use worldwide to help prevent the more devastating effects of disease and illness.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, with all of the different specialties that are going, right, that we have our own sort of things that we've seen in our specialties, you know, and especially I know with that, with children, there's always something unexpected happening or some sudden change. Yes. And with children, it can happen very quickly too, right? So, so seeing that those things happen, and obviously you've been exposed to them and had to kind of work through those changes, can you tell us of a time maybe in your personal professional life where you were encountered with a sudden change or unexpected condition that later had an impact in your personal life or your professional life and how you sort of go about things now or see the world even?
I can say that this was my first year, like shortly after finishing my residency. So I'm a new attending, fresh out a few months. And I had a patient come in who wasn't feeling well, had high fevers, cold symptoms, and it was winter time. And I did think to do flu testing. This was one of the few years the child was not vaccinated. And the flu was positive. So then I did prescribe Tamiflu and gave guidance as far as going home. This is things you should do. This is what you should look for and all of that. Child goes home. And initially the child improved for a day. But the following day started having trouble breathing and wasn't acting like themselves. And then when they really were not responding, family called 911, child collapsed with frothing from the mouth. It was very devastating. They rushed the child to the hospital and ended up that the child, even though was with given Tamiflu, still ended up getting the bad effects of flu that people do not think about. And the child unfortunately passed away. And the reason that I even know about this is that I was the last doctor on record having seen her. So then the Department of Health contacted me to ask what exactly what happened, review the case. Then the family asked to speak to me, which was also very traumatizing. Thankfully, they were understanding and they just wanted to know if there was anything else. You know, so I reviewed everything with them. They were extremely gracious. They even appreciated the fact that I even bothered to check for flu because they were like, they may, you know, someone else may not have. And I did try to do what I could and I did tell them things to do. So it wasn't like they were left blind. And I even had to talk to the child's pediatrician who also admitted that, you know, there wasn't anything that they would have done differently. So yes, I have that knowledge, but at the same time, I also have a child that was lost and it hits differently when you have a child who was lost outpatient, meaning not in the hospital, right? When it's sadly, we have become desensitized to some bad outcomes in the hospital, especially in the ICU. Yeah. Right. But to be thinking this child came in, you think they're well, and then next thing you know, they're gone. That is something that stays with me. So as a result, as I'm already was strong on a very pro vaccine, but then after that, I'm very pro flu vaccine because of that, because I do have a very vivid example in my mind. I still remember to this day, it was years ago, that will stick with me forever. And when people say, oh, it's not that bad, or when they say, oh, when I get the flu shot, I still get sick. And it's like, okay, you do not know bad flu. Did you have to get hospitalized?
Right.
Were you in the ICU? Did you have to get intubated where they had to stick a tube down your throat to help you breathe? Are you still here? These are things that happen with bad flu. If you were able to stay home for a week and you just felt lousy in your bed, that is not bad flu. And people do not realize that. And worldwide, influenza kills people every single year. And that is why we do such a good job as best we can of vaccinating against it every single season. And now we're going to be going into the flu season again and also trying to push for that. And, you know, and then similarly, you and I were trying to push for COVID. And I've seen in COVID itself in 2020, when the pandemic first hit, because New York City was an epicenter, the number of people that I saw that were affected and unfortunately lost their lives was traumatizing. And I remember the month of April, 2020. So that was right after we went on lockdown in March, right? Mm-hmm. So April. So for the month of April, 2020, every single day, except for 5 days, there was at least one person that I knew between family, friends of close family, friends or neighbors who passed away that I knew every single day, except for 5 days.
Wow.
So it felt like I was in some war torn country where you're thinking every day you're getting a call or a text or an update of this one is gone. This one is gone. This was gone. Unreal. Right. So then I'm also very pro COVID vaccine where people are like, oh, well, you can still get the illness. Once again, did you live? Right. You know, that for to have that many people and that was just in a month.
Yeah.
You know, and let alone the pandemic was going for 3 years and then it's still not over, but the cases are lower, but they're starting to creep back up again. So I really still try to push that as well as other things. And last thing I remember, I actually had a patient. There's certain things that I've seen that, you know, as a physician, a lot of things people do not see in general public. So I have seen pertussis, which is what we protect against when they think about whooping cough, right?
Yeah.
The bacteria that causes that is pertussis. So I've seen the little babies that are in the hospital because when they're under the age of 4 months, they can become apneic, which means they stop breathing. So now you have to have them admitted until the bacteria runs, like the illness runs its course. And then what ends up happening is they cough, 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 cough. They get so tired that they have to take a breath of, oh! And that's what the whooping is when they talk about whooping coughs. So adults will not whoop. They can still get pertussis and pass it on to everybody else, but they will not whoop. The little infants will, because they're fatigued. They cough, 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 whoop, and they whoop. And then they'll have a time when they stop breathing. They will go apneic. Mm-hmm. So they have to get admitted on apnea monitors that will detect that there's no oxygen being exchanged. And then the alarm goes off. And what happens? Someone has, whoever's closest, has to go running into the bed and stimulate the baby by like flicking their feet, rubbing their chest, things like that. I know you know. But the general public does not know this. So they think that, oh, why do I need to get my, why does my baby need to get the DTaP? Why is it when I get older, they said the TD wasn't enough. I need to get the TDAP, because we are trying to prevent you from spreading pertussis to the little one who's going to have to be in the hospital for weeks. Yeah. It's not like a 2-day sort of thing. When they get pertussis, they are in the hospital for weeks. And then when you work in the hospital, you'll come in and it'll be like day 10 of stay. Still here.
Right.
Still apneic.
Right. Right.
So things like that are measles. I actually saw measles, and it was interesting because that's an airborne illness. And they had in the hospital that I was working at was a community-based hospital. So they did not have the negative pressure rooms. So they had to shut the floor down. And the way we found out. So we admitted the child the night before, they're on the regular floor. We come in the morning, they locked the doors and they would not let us in. So we had to wait in the call room. And So then one by one, they were calling for our records from Student Health Services to see were we vaccinated. And as they cleared us one by one, we were allowed into the unit because they didn't want to be responsible, since we are still residents in training, that someone got measles during workday. Because measles, yes, you know, for most people, just like chickenpox, it can just cause high fevers, rashes. They don't feel so well for about a week or so, and then they feel better. But in very rare cases, for both chickenpox and measles, and mumps as well, chickenpox and measles specifically, they can get encephalitis, which is infection and swelling of the brain tissue. So encephalitis is terrible, right? So this is something that is very important, that even if it only happens rarely, who wants to risk that? So I'm very, very pro-vaccine.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, because I think that the general public, like you mentioned, sometimes it takes very lightly, right? Why some of us are most of us are adamant about people really getting vaccinated and what the reasoning behind it is, because we've seen what someone who's not vaccinated looks like, or unfortunately sometimes what can happen, you know, in terms of outcomes from not, you know, being vaccinated. So it's something that I think is important to still talk about, obviously. You know, it became something that we really, really talked about a whole lot, obviously, during COVID, just because of the numbers. I mean, the sheer number of people who were just, you know, dying from the disease in what I would consider a short period of time. I mean, we're talking over a year span or 2 year span.
Right.
So thank you for sharing that. It is important to continue to talk about that. And I think it's important for us to share those experiences, you know, with the students and the people of the Gambia as well. So one of the things that, you know, I think for a number of us, we are looking for that, you know, exchange of knowledge. Obviously, we're going to bring something and they're hopefully going to give us something back. And one of the things that we often talk about is just the way in which, you know, they treat patients, because obviously it's very different. They don't have a lot of the resources that we have. So sometimes the community even has to just rely on, you know, traditional medicine or traditional, you know, herbs and things like that. So what are you hoping maybe to learn about that? Or what do you currently kind of know about that particular type of treatment modality?
That is one of the things that I am also so excited to learn. I want to learn more about the more of the homeopathic things, because they don't really teach us that much in traditional allopathic medical school where you earn your MD. They do teach a little bit though for osteopathic medicine, for those DOs. And they also teach them manipulation sort of methods, which I wish I had learned as an MD or even knew about, because I may have considered becoming a DO, because they do the same medical school process. But in addition to, they learn some of these other modalities that I don't really know. So I really would like to see how they treat the people in the Gambia, where they may not have all the same resources we do have. So it's something like an apnea monitor. I'm sure those are very expensive. So how are they treating a child if they ever were to come in with pertussis, or even if there's other reasons a child may become apneic because they were premature, right? And that affects their breathing center as well. So then what are they doing for that? And how are they treating any other sort of thing as far as illnesses and injuries, how they come in? What if, you know, we have all these these tests, we are very spoiled. We have all these modalities where we can just run a test. We can order an imaging sort of thing, be it an X-ray, CAT scan, ultrasound, an MRI. Even if it's not done with immediately, we can get it done, right? But then what if you're in a place where they do not have all these modalities readily available? So how are they, what are they doing? Because they're still diagnosing things. They are now just going back and they're just using the more traditional methods. And I'm sure they're so much better with their hands, right? So then something that is like, oh, well, if you feel this or you see that, then you need to think about this. That is something that I need to learn. And I'm very excited to learn that. I'm very excited to learn homeopathic things, because my thing is, if it's not going to hurt the patient and in ways it could help the patient, then who am I to say, no, do not do this sort of treatment? Now, there are some things though that, you know, some people make the mistake that, oh, because it's alternative, it's better. And whereas every person is different and some things may not be good for you, which is why you should discuss it with your primary. To see whether or not that particular treatment plan is good for you, or something that even if it may not be proven to be beneficial, at least it will not be harmful to you. So if it's not something that's going to be harmful, then I need to know it. Especially, I live in New York City, right? So I grew up in Brooklyn. I'm now working in the Bronx. I have a lot of I have a large population of patients who are from West Africa. I think I might actually have had a student who is from the Gambia who I'm so excited to say, I will be visiting Gambia. And you know, they're like, wow, no one's ever said that before. Right. So I could even say that. Yeah. So then even being able to learn how the Gambian medicine and how I can incorporate that, I'm sure that'd be such an appreciation to be able to bring West African medicine, specifically medicine from the Gambia, and incorporate it into my practice. So I'm very excited to learn these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Sarah, this has been an amazing interview. I'm so glad that we got to reconnect so that, and also learn so much more about each other. And we'll always have that Brooklyn connection.
I know. Always. Round of applause again.
That's right. Yes. Brooklyn. So thank you again. I'm excited for this trip, excited to work with you and, you know, just fellowship with everyone there, and looking forward to all the good things I know will come out of this trip.
Oh yes, I'm super excited. I need to get that ticket.
Yes. All right, well, you take care and thank you again.
Oh, you too, have a good night. Thanks for having me. Bye. Absolutely. Bye everybody.
Thank you for listening and for allowing us to be a part of your day. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to receive any new episodes as they are released.
Thanks again for listening today. If you'd like to support the Gambia Project, simply go to your browser and type gambiacollaborative.org. That's www.gambiacollaborative.org.
We hope you will join us on the road to the Gambia.
If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Healthcare for Humans, hosted by Dr. Sundar, expands our understanding of the history and culture of different communities and how to provide culturally responsive care. there's an episode you should check out where guest Dr. Duran details the systemic barriers faced by individuals with DACA status and highlights the importance of addressing these barriers. Check out Healthcare for Humans on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.